Welcome to Live from My Drum Room. Today is a special episode celebrating Hal Blaine's 95th birthday. I had the great honor of knowing Hal for 30 years. He was my dear friend, and he would have turned 95 on February 5th, 2024. I actually attended his 90th birthday party in 2019, a historic event in and of itself at the Baked Potato in Los Angeles. And for most of us, it was the last time we saw Hal. He passed away in March of 2019. So I put together this show to celebrate his 95th birthday, kind of a long overdue episode to celebrate Hal. And you'll see I'm joined by Denny Tedesco, director and producer of course, the Wrecking Crew documentary, and most recently, the Immediate Family documentary. Also the son of legendary Wrecking Crew guitarist Tommy Tedesco, Hal's good friend. Also joining me is Don Randy, legendary Wrecking Crew keyboard player and also the owner of the Baked Potato in Los Angeles, a legendary club. My former boss and my dear friend, Don Lombardi, who is the founder of DW Drums Drum Workshop, and two outstanding drummers and dear friends, Clem Burke from the band Blondie, and Dennis Dykin from the Smithereens, also very good friends of Hal. And later, we'll be joined by the man himself, Jim Keltner, who I refer to as the Jedi Master. Jim Keltner will also join us a little ways into the show. So I hope you enjoy this. One of my favorite episodes, and I think you're going to love it. We all loved Hal and still love him, and we all miss him like crazy. And he was just one of a kind. And I hope if you never met him or never knew him, that you know him a little bit better and a little bit more after this episode. So thanks for watching. Buckle your seatbelts. It's going to be a lot of fun. And please subscribe to my YouTube channel. I'll see you on the other side. So please welcome to this special episode celebrating Hal Blaine's 95th birthday, Denny Tedesco, Clem Burke, Don Lombardi. But wait, there's more. Don Randy, welcome, my friends. Thanks for being here today. We'll get the show started. Here comes Dennis Dykin. All right. All right. And I want to just mention that a couple of people that originally were going to be here aren't able to be here today. And that is Ingrid Fasching, who runs the Hal Blaine Facebook page. 21,000 members and still growing. It's a great Facebook page. And she does a great job. She's unable to make it today. She was a little under the weather, but hopefully she's watching. And our dear friend Danny Serafin had originally said he'd be here today, but realized he had another appointment booked already and had to pass or back out at the last second. But Danny did ask me to read this, which I will do right now. I asked Danny just to give me a quick little comment about Hal, and he said, "Hal had a massive influence on my playing, and later, after getting to know him, my life. He was a good friend, always willing to share his wisdom with me. He's greatly missed by all of us. P.S. If you listen to my drum part on the Chicago song Beginnings, it's basically a tribute to Hal Blaine," which is so great. I never put that together, but when I thought about it, it's absolutely a tribute to Hal playing the concert toms and those big roundhouse fills. So anyway.
Yeah, I can hear that.
So Danny's here in spirit, and hopefully with any luck, Jim Keltner will join us as well. It'd be great to get some Jim Keltner stories. But I'm going to jump in. I'm going to, looking at my screen, Danny, you're kind of the first face I see. Maybe you can share some stories or a story about, no, it's a good face. No, I mean, you have a history with Hal because your dad, of course, the legendary Tommy Tedesco, member of the Wrecking Crew, Hal's best friend. I know you have 10,000 stories. Also the producer and director of the fabulous Wrecking Crew documentary. But maybe share a story.
You know what? Everybody is. I didn't know Hal. I mean, I knew Hal as a kid, but mostly by his name. I mean, I saw him occasionally at a dinner party or something like that with his wife, Lydia, at the time. But Dad, I knew these guys. As soon as I did the documentary, that's when I really got to know Don and Hal and all these guys. Because dad didn't mix home with too much with work. So it's funny because I think Don and I talked about this. I think Don Randy and I have hung out longer and been closer than he was with my dad. Is that right, Don?
Okay. For me, doing that and talking about your father, who happens to be probably one of the greatest musicians of all time, you know, and to be able to sit next to him many times and just go through that. And then you turn to the left and there's Hal Blaine. I was like a pig in slop, as they say. You know, it was an amazing time. I didn't know anything about recording or doing any of that stuff. For me, it was a brand new. These guys had some experience. And to be surrounded by them was amazing. And Hal was always very helpful to everyone. You know, to new drummers, somebody that wanted to know about it, he would take them under his wing or bring them in and be very helpful. He never was anti, you know, another drummer, that's for sure.
Yeah.
You know what Dad always said, which was really interesting about Hal, was he goes, Hal could be, he would give this 110% if it was a Spector date or it was a bar mitzvah. It didn't matter. It was a gig that he just like, you know, it wasn't, you know, he never came in half-ass.
That's true. Yeah. Very true.
And I think it seems, you know, just from everything I've, from knowing Hal and I've learned Denny through the documentary and knowing Don, it seemed like all you guys, all the members of the Wrecking Crew took every date, regardless of, like you say, what it was, whether it was a Frank Sinatra date or a pop band of the week, of the month date, it was just as important and just as serious to do the best job they could.
The first time I met Hal was on a record date for Phil Spector. He's a Rebel with the Crystals. And then we didn't see each other for a couple of months. And I had a gig at a place called the Saharan in Chicago. And I'm walking down the hallway to go to my gig. And here's Hal Blaine walking right at me. And we're looking at it, and he says, Don, I say, Hal. And we hadn't seen each other till, and we've been friends. We were friends ever since that day. He was there with Patty Page in the main room, and we were in the lounge with my trio.
Wow.
It was kind of neat.
What year was that, Don, if you could take a guess?
1962.
Wow, man. So 60 years.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's pretty amazing. And you know, in those days, the very first date, the guitar players were Barney Kessel, Tommy Tedesco, Howard Roberts, and then a guy by the name of Russ Titelman, who was also playing rhythm guitar, who later became a very famous producer.
Yeah.
And Russ was kind of the gopher for everybody. And Hal Blaine, of course, was the drummer. And he always had two bass players. Jimmy Bond would be one, and then whoever he would have on Fender, sometimes Ray Pullman, sometimes Lyle Ritz, a whole bunch of different characters, you know.
Not Carol? Wasn't around yet?
Not Carol. Carol didn't do the Phil Spectors on bass.
She played guitar.
She played guitar on the Spector stuff.
She did a couple of good dates that she played guitar on. But I don't think I can remember her playing bass on anything.
Oh, wow.
For Phil. No, not really. Well, I could be wrong.
I think I heard of Pet Sounds when you did Pet Sounds.
With she was Brian around then. That was
that's
different.
Later, that was Brian. Later, yeah.
That was Brian.
Yeah.
But that was Hal.
All
right. Wow. You know what Hal did as a drummer that I noticed? He would listen to this song, and then out would come the tuning key, and he started tuning his drums to be sympathetic with the key that the singer was going to be singing or where it was. He always would retune on. I don't care who the day was. If he heard something immediately out that came out, and he would tune the drums to be sympathetic to the track. Now most other drummers just came in and play, you know.
Yeah.
Most of the time they don't stop to tune, but he did constantly.
Did he tune to he would tune to the key of the song or
I think Yeah, whatever would, I guess that's what I would guess. It was the key.
Just in sympathy to the way the song sounded.
Wow.
Of course. Yeah. You got to remember, Hal could sing. When he sang, he sang like Frank Sinatra. I mean, he had a real crooning voice, and he loved to sing. He loved to sing.
He never did any recording singing, did he? I mean, he did solo records with drums, but not singing, though.
No, one of my favorite stories is when we were on tour with Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., and Nancy Sinatra for Hubert Humphrey when he was running for president, when they all were still Democrats.
I mean, yeah, I was going to say a good Democrat, yeah.
Yeah. So we were in Minneapolis, Minnesota on a Sunday where they have a blue law. There's no booze, no food. Everything closes down. And we did an early morning concert for a fundraiser for Hugh Humphrey. And we got back and we were starving. So Hal says, called. I said, Hal, every place is closed in the hotel. He says, well, I saw somebody walking in when we were coming out. I said, everybody's going to the White House to get hamburgers. And he said, no. Tell them it's from Frank Sinatra. I said, I can't do that. We were staying in the same room, so I pick up the phone. He talks me into it, and I call down, and somebody answers. And I said, oh, shit, now I'm really stuck. I said, okay, I'm calling for Mr. Sinatra, and we're in room 117, whatever it was. And I said, we want to order. He said, well, but we're closed. I said, are you sure we can't get just a little something? And he said, just a second, my boss is coming. And then the head guy of the restaurant comes, and he says, sure, for Mr. Sinatra, we can do it, right? So we order a couple of steaks and baked potatoes. And within a half hour here, there's a knock on the door. And I look at Hal, I said, what do we do now? Hal goes in the bathroom and turns the shower on. And he starts singing, come fly with me, fly up to. And I open the door. The shower is on. The guy's looking around. Where's Mr. Sinatra? Where's him? And he can hear Hal singing in the shower. And he leaves the stuff. And he goes out. I sign for it. He goes out the door, and Hal comes out. And he looks. He says, "Where's the rolls?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "They forgot to bring the rolls." I said, "I'm not calling back." He talks me into calling back. The guy went and got rolls. He comes back and knocks on the door again. Hal goes back in the shower. He starts singing again. Come fly with me. I said, "This is impossible." And the guy leaves it and goes away. we pulled it off. So when we got back, Hal said we got to leave our trays outside the door. So we both left our trays so that when everybody came back from the White House, they're going to wonder, how did those guys eat? And we didn't get food here. Anyway, that's Hal Blaine, you know.
Oh, my God.
You know, I do have a record that Hal sings on.
Oh, wow.
It's from the early 70s.
Ah,
and he did a Christmas record called Alfie the Christmas Tree. It wasn't under his name. It was called The Frogs. And it was on Mum's label. And he did his own voice singing kind of low. And then he did like a Chipmunk's Varispeed on his voice. So it's not like really straight singing, but he is the singer on the record. So it's a bit of a curio at best, but.
Glad to hear that. Oh, is he credited as Hal on the record, or you had to research that to find out it was Hal's?
It's under the name of Frogs.
Right.
Frogs.
But it's clearly Hal. I think he's got the maybe production and writer credit on it, too.
Okay.
Yeah, but he speaks a little bit on it too. It's like a children's record kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But so maybe that's the only thing he sang on. He did sing a little bit, I think. He did on a Gary Lewis record. It was a promotional thing for, I think, Corn Flakes. And it was called Do the Flake. And he's singing on that, flake, flake, do the flake, flake, flake. And there was one other record where he did like an incidental vocal part. So there is audio evidence of him warbling out there, which is pretty cool.
Well, he had such a great baritone, natural baritone voice, you know.
Hey, John, can I get this out of the way now? I don't know if you remember this, but years ago when you were still at Zildjian, I guess it's sometime in the, probably in the early mid 90s, I was at the time I did it better. I did a little imitation of Hal.
Okay. I remember. Yes.
And I called John and got his voicemail at Zildjian. Hey, John, it's Hal calling. No big deal. Just checking in. Want to see how you're doing. You don't have to call back, but you bought it.
I did buy it. It was perfect, man. It was perfect. I absolutely. And that's still, you still got it, Dennis. I mean, but that you had it down. Because every time after that, when I'd see you, I'd say, Dennis, we'll get to how you're doing in a minute, but you got to give me a Hal Blaine, you know?
Well, you know, I think you told me you actually did call him back.
Yeah. I don't know what you're talking about, John. I mean, I didn't call you.
Oh, I'm fine, John. I'm fine.
When did you first meet Hal, Dennis?
You know, it was a great moment for me. I wrote him a fan letter in 1982. Okay. And just somebody got me his address. And I just wanted to make contact with him because his playing meant so much to me, as it does to everybody here. And within a week, there was a reply from Hal. It blew my mind. He got right back to me, gave me his phone number. And we started corresponding and chatting on the phone. And then finally, he was coming to New York in 1985. He was doing a tour with David Grisman, the bluegrass mandolinist. Mm-hmm. And, Dan, I'm coming to New York, so finally get to meet you. Oh, great, Al. You're touring with Grisman, huh? I says, yep. Playing Boston, blah, 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 D.C. So what drums are you using for the tour? He says, oh, we're just renting gear. Hey, Hal, you want to use my kit? He says, oh, I wouldn't want to impose. No, it's okay. So they played the bottom line, and he used my drums. I couldn't believe it.
Wow, man.
I was his valet for the day. I drove him to his hotel, and we hung out, and we had already bonded quite a bit from corresponding. He was such a giving guy, even to, you know, just people who would drop him a line. He just would spend time. I have so many. I still have all the correspondence in the pre-email days. If he just wanted it, I'm sure some of you guys have this too. He would just drop a postcard, a little beat from Hal Blaine, it said on it. And then just saying, like, I saw you on the Tonight Show last night. Great. You guys were great. Or, you know, I'm still looking for that album you asked about. I'll get back to you. He was always stay in touch and always be encouraging. And, you know,
that's amazing.
And we stayed friends. And you all know what it was like. He's just a life. Once you were friends with Hal, you had a true friend for life.
That's absolutely true. He was serious about staying in touch with people.
Very much.
He was a people lover. He was a good guy. He was one of the better guys. Yeah. If he could help you out, he would. I wouldn't want to be on the bad side of it because, as you well know, him and Carol did not get along, and he could take it out pretty good too. You know, but. Sometimes it justified some. Denny Tedesco and I, when they would be showing the Wrecking Crew film, here's an interesting story. Hal and I would be there for the Q&A most of the time when we can to be there together. And we were doing a show in Palm Springs at some golf course, I think it was. I can't remember exactly. Denny might be able to fill that in. But we had a plan. The plan was when the Wrecking Crew film would come on, before Carol started speaking, my job was to take Hal out of the movie completely and say, Hal, I'm hungry. Let's get the hell out of here. Let's grab something. We can grab something to eat and then come back. So he wouldn't be there for Carol's part because when it would come on, he would say the loudest, rudest things to the screen. And the audience would hear him, you know, and it got to be a little annoying. To me, it was funny, but to no one else it was. So we'd have to get him out of the room. And I'd say, come on, we'll go across the street. There's a place, we'll grab a burger or something. And I'd make sure it took at least a half hour so that we could get back in time for the rest of the film and then do the Q&A. Pretty That's funny. Great.
What was the, origin of that feud? Do you know any? Was it from day one?
Yeah, I don't know if it was from day one because they had to work together many times. Right. You know, so I don't think it was from day one. I think there was always a rub because Carol was a bit of a yenta on dates, and she would talk, you know, and that would annoy us because we were trying to get out of one place so that we could get to the next place on time. And a lot of times she would stretch it, you know.
But, to get to the next session.
Exactly. Yeah. So what would happen, I think she played on so much stuff that she forgets. And a number of times she said she played on things that she didn't really play on. And that was a big rub to Hal. And they just didn't get along. They just never got along. And it went on for years, I guess. You know, Carol went her way and Hal went the other way. But that, you know, that's life. She moved right near where he moved out to a place, and she ended up moving a block away. And that really pissed him off. He couldn't handle that too well.
Hey, look who's joined us, gentlemen. None other than Jim Keltner.
Hey, Jim.
All right. Hey, Jim.
Great to see you, Jim.
Well, came anyway.
He came, he saw, he conquered. He'll be back.
By the way, I got a note from Michael Kravitz, which is Hal's nephew.
Oh, and right. He was at the induction there in Palm Springs, right?
Yeah, now. he was the one that put that together. Yeah. And he said he sang Flat, Broke, and Lonesome, the country tune. It was a demo with Don Randy.
Remember that, Don? That's right. I do remember that.
Oh, too funny. Before Jim Keltner comes back, and I know he will, I'd love to hear what my old boss, young former boss, Don Lombardi, maybe could share a story about Hal. I don't know. I think you guys go back a ways, but I know he became a DW artist in the last years of his life, too.
Actually, there's Jim coming back. Actually, I could tell you a story that relates to the interview I did with Jim that he will remember. Hi, Jim. It's Don. We'll all say hi. We actually can see you now. We did an interview, interviewed Charlie Watts at one point. And when it was over, we got talking. I said, yeah, I'm going to have Hal Blaine out and want to do an interview with him. And Charlie said, would love to be a part of that if I could. And of course, I said, well, absolutely. So we did the roundtable with Jim, Charlie. And at the end of it, we were in my office. And Charlie turned to me and said, Don, could you get a drum head and a black Sharpie? And I thought, well, that's nice. He wants to sign something for me. This will be really cool. So I go out and I get a drum head and a black Sharpie. I come in, I hand it to Charlie. He turns to Hal and says, Hal, could I get your signature, please?
I love it. Oh.
You've arrived at that point. Jim was in the room standing with me at the same time. He'll remember that. Great times and a lot of stories. I mean, he went on in those interviews and told some amazing stories about basically inventing drum techs back in the day and all the things he had to go through with the unions. And you remember those stories, Don, for sure. I asked him once, I said, you know, when you go to all these different sessions, multiple ones, you know, day after day and in a variety of different genres, what's the first thing that you want to find out when you get down and sit down? From a drummer's perspective, I figured he was going to talk about, you know, I want to know the genre, the tempo, the vibe. It wasn't. It was simply, I want to know about the story. I want to know about the lyrics. And that was a life-changing, I think, lesson for a lot of drummers. I play that over and over anytime I sit down with anybody and have them want to study. He really understood the musicality of what it takes. And speaking of Mr. Musicality, there is Jim. There's a great picture. There's the picture. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That was behind the baked potato. I'm sure Don Randy recognizes that backdrop there. That was at Hal's 90th birthday party after when Charlie and Jim were making their exit. That's one of my absolute favorite photos of all time right there. Look at that. My two heroes.
Yep.
Well.
How wonderful that was, you know, how important all the drummers were paying homage to Hal Blaine, you know. And I never quite understood that, you know, until that birthday party when I saw it was not only out of friendship, it was out of respect, too.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, you see a guy like Clem Burr coming up and playing it, and Danny Carey being there, and Chad Smith, you know, all these guys from famous bands. And then Jim Keltner walks in with Sir Charles, you know, pretty amazing. Pretty wonderful.
You remember when that night went down, the planning of it, which Michael and, you know, Michael Kravitz was doing, there was moments where it was like, you know, how Hal could get testy. And we go, oh, God, you know, is he even going to show up? Because he was, you know, wasn't well, this and that. And, we had this big thing planned for him. And it was like, just all he needs to do is just be there just for the first set. You know what I mean? Just so, you know, and then that'll be it. That'll be it. And he could go home. He closed the place. Everybody was gone. Until the last person was in the,
that's right.
He signed everybody's autograph till the end. I mean, I left before he was finished. I think you did too, Don. I think we all left at that point. He was still signing.
I think Justin was. Yes, that's right.
He played those three songs.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing. But that was Hal. He took the time to be a people person, and he had to be. He wanted to do that. He didn't do it because he had to. It was his ability to handle the situation too. And there were times you can imagine you want to get the hell out of there, but he would always take that time. You know, spend it with people, good folks, good man.
You know, Don, you mentioned. You know, the guys like Danny Carey and Chad Smith, you know, being there that night and paying their respects because, you know, they were fans of Hal's. And I can tell you all the years, and Clem knows about this, and Dennis, I don't know if you ever made it to any of the NAMM shows that Zildjian had the big autograph sessions, but Clem was certainly part of those. And it's funny, we'd have these younger drummers like Travis Barker or Trey Cool or somebody who are certainly famous, great drummers, well known, but they'd all see Hal there, and even those guys knew who he was and would. And I remember a couple of times, some of those guys saying, "Can you sit me next to Hal? I'd love to talk to him just for a minute." And there was so much respect. I mean, he transcended all these generations, I think, is what, and all thanks, I think, largely to the book. I think the book really helped kind of make people aware of exactly how important he was, you know, all those recordings you guys did in the Wrecking Crew. And then years later when Denny did the documentary, of course, that just kind of really, I think, made him like a household name. I think along the lines of like a Buddy Rich, you know, I mean, like that well known.
I think you're right. And I think what speaks to all generations of drummers and musicians and just music fans, what the essence of those records, it, certainly stemming from Hal's playing, but all the guys in the Wrecking Crew and certainly Don's playing too, but Hal had so much humanity in expressed in his playing. I think that's what speaks to the world and draws people to want to know who created the feels of those records. There's something almost intangible that he expressed from his heart and from his soul in every session he did. And I really think that's what will keep that music living for centuries, just because it's so special that emanated from his heart and soul.
It's everything you said, and it's also... He had a wonderful sense of humor. There he is. There's Jim. How you doing, my friend?
So I'm sorry that I came late, man. I love what you guys are saying about Hal.
When was the first time you met him, Jim?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
I met him at the session with Gary Lewis.
Okay.
And I knew nothing about any Hal Blaine or Gary Lewis or Leon Russell or anything. Well, I knew Gary because he came into the music store where I was working in Pasadena, he was studying acting at the Pasadena Playhouse. And when he came in, you know, I've told this story many times, and he wanted me to be his drummer. And finally, he coerced me with $250 a week compared to my 80. I was happy playing with Don. I was playing with the freaking Don Randy, man. And I had made it as far as I'm concerned. I'm playing on the Strip, playing jazz on the Strip, Sunset Strip. And it was fantastic. So it took me, it was a bit of a thing, you know, for me to join Gary. So the first thing we did was go into the studio, and Hal was there. And I had known about Hal, and they told me that he was there to play tambourine and percussion things. But later I found out he was there because they didn't know if I'd be able to cut it, you know. I mean, if you can't play properly on a record, time is money. They've got to have somebody there that can. Anyway, that day, it was the first day that I realized, like somebody, Dennis, I think, was just talking about his humanity.
Mm.
Hal was like, he turned into my uncle. He turned into, I could just ask him anything, and he made fun of stuff. He joked around. He was like my dad. And it just, I felt so comfortable. It was ridiculous. And then a couple of times there was, and of all things, you'll appreciate this as drummers. You're playing music, Gary Lewis type of rock and roll, Gary Lewis Playboys rock and roll stuff. And why we had charts. We had chart. And so I'm looking at my chart, and I'm, you know, fortunately I could read, but I didn't know exactly, like, I remember looking at this figure, and I said, how would you play this? So I could never have asked any of the really hip guys, the guys that, you know, that were really cool and everything, because I just wouldn't have, I would have felt really stupid asking him, but how allowed me to ask him anything. I just had that feeling I could ask him anything. I said, how do you play this? I didn't want to say, how do I play this? Because I knew I could play it, but how, what sounds, what would I lead with? Where would I end up? And he said, he just sat down behind the drum and said, I play it like this. And then a boom, bash. And I, you know, I just said, oh. And I remember thinking, what a revelation that is. I would never have done that. I mean, I would never have instinctively done that. I would have thought, okay, that's going to be too loud to end with a crash cymbal. Because I think somebody earlier in the session had told me, don't play too many cymbals. So, and they were right about that. You know, that's kind of one of the first things you learn in recording, is you go easy on the cymbals, and you pick out the right kind of cymbals and stuff. And Hal's cymbals were unbelievably beautiful. Thin old A's.
Yeah.
And later on when I got with Paiste, I tried to copy that. And fortunately, they're so fantastic. They made cymbals very, very similar to that. But that was the day that I first met Hal, and he was just absolutely like a combination of a drum teacher for me, like the guy that, you know, he wrote the book, and it was just, you know, it started a relationship that I really felt. It was like one of the first real relationships I had in the music business that made me feel like I was one of them. And I think that's probably hard to get that feeling, you know, for a lot of people when they first come in.
Mm-hmm.
But he embraced me in such a way. You know, and I must say, while we're on the subject, Ringo did the same thing to me. And we just had a conversation about that recently. You know, it's really important how when you come into a situation like that, like both of these, you know, I'm here with the Hal thing, with the Gary Lewis thing. I didn't realize it was like Gary Lewis had a big hit record with Hal Blaine playing on it, right? This Diamond Ring. Mm-hmm. That was a big record. And so, you know, a lot was on the line for his next record. And I didn't realize any of that. And it could have been it could have been disastrous, or it could have been sort of mediocre, or it could have been anything. But what it turned out to be, it turned out to be fantastic. Leon was producing, and he leaned over to me during a playback, and he said, "You're going to be a great rock drummer." And I'm a jazz drummer, and I didn't want to be a great rock drummer, but I knew the impact. I felt the impact of him saying that. And then Hal had those same kind of words for me. He would encourage me. He made me feel like I was gonna be good, and I would know how to do this kind of thing. Anyway, so I'm sorry to be taking up all the time here.
No,
but,
Jim,
that's what Hal Blaine. I can't say enough about Hal Blaine, man. And I have in every interview I've ever done. Hal was not only a mentor; he was like, honest to God, like a surrogate father. He was like a big brother, and most of all, he was the cat that just, when you got to see him play, and there's another perk, you know, imagine sitting behind Hal Blaine while he's playing with these freaking Wrecking Crew guys. It was more than a lesson that you could imagine. I mean, I just remember the power. He used tiny little sticks. I don't know if everybody knows that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, he used little sticks, but he was a big guy, and he had big hands, big forearm, big old hairy forearms, I guess he didn't need to use big sticks, so he got this tremendous, powerful sound with these little sticks, but more than that, he had a leader quality. You know, Don would know this more than, you know, anybody. Don, you were there at all those sessions. You know, he it felt like he was kind of the leader. That's what I felt like.
You know, you're absolutely right. And he made it easier for you to play, for everybody else. And I remember the date when you were sitting behind him. I'll never forget that. And just saying, only Hal would do that. But you know, Earl was like that too. Earl Palmer would do stuff like that too. But yeah. Hal was so special when it came. Hal had that wonderful sense of humor that made you relax.
Right.
You felt like you knew him for 100 years. You know, right away. And I mean, he admired you. He always spoke highly of you. You know, he was good. He was a good man. Good guy.
Yeah, I know, man. He later on in life, you realize that sense of humor that he brought to the studio was so important, man. That's there was huge money on the line for those things. You guys were playing on the biggest records of the day, and that's some big important shit to be doing. And you had to be able to relax and do your best, you know. And like you just said, Hal was a big part of that and allowing everybody to laugh. You know, I remember he would say the funniest stuff.
Yeah.
And later on, I would try to do it and it didn't work.
Yeah. We were doing a date at Gold Star one time for Phil Spector. I forget. I think it was the Ronettes. I'm not sure. But after we were there about 2 hours, there's a phone ringing.
Yeah.
In the studio. And we stopped, and Phil says, "What's that ringing?" I had nobody knows. We do another couple hours. You know, Phil is on one tune for 10 hours. So we do another couple hours, and the phone is ringing again, and who hears it? And Phil says, "What the hell is going on in there? Somebody's got a phone." No, no. About two more hours go by, and the phone is ringing, but this time he lets it ring and ring, and Phil is going crazy. He says, "What the fuck is going on?" And Hal opens up his case, and he takes out the phone. "Hello? Oh, Phil, it's for you." He had gotten one of those prop phones from one of the studio gigs he was doing, and he had one of those prop phones in his case in the middle of a million-dollar date, right? That's how it went.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Jim, did he And over the years, he referred a lot of work to you, didn't he? As you were starting out and Hal was already pretty well established, it was all that work.
What he did was he threw me, I always say that he threw me in the deep end because I didn't have cartage. I didn't know what cartage, I didn't know anything. And, but he told somebody to call me. It was a Jimmy Webb commercial. Jimmy Webb was doing this commercial for Goodyear tires. And I didn't know any of that either. I didn't know who Jimmy Webb was. They didn't tell me it was a Goodyear tire. They didn't tell me anything. It was just a date. And it was a TT&G. And any of y'all who know TT&G, you know that it's an elevator up to the room. And here I am walking from my Volkswagen that's got all my drums in the cases, and I'm bringing everything up in the elevator. And I walk in this room, this big room. TT&G is a big room up there, right? And I walk in this room. And I see a whole orchestra. I see string players, horns, rhythm section. Everybody's there. And the drum place where the drums are supposed to be is a big hole. There's no drums there because I'm late. Oh, boy. So I'm late to a very important date, an extremely important date. I mean, this is Jimmy Webb, man. You know, and I remember he was so sweet, though. He was really nice to me. And I really appreciated that because I was sweating and I remember this distinctly, and all the musicians I've ever told this story to laugh so hard. I remember distinctly the look that the string players gave me as I walked. Who in the fuck is this late hippie? Dude, my hair was really long and I don't know. And I'm carrying my drums in, and I'm setting them up one by one. And you just only have to imagine the humiliation, you know, that I was feeling.
That's a great story, though. That's wonderful.
Well, yeah, but the person that actually saved me that day was Mike Dacey. Anybody remember Mike Dacey?
Oh yeah, very well. Yeah.
Mike Dacey, out of all the people in that room, you know, like the string players were all, they were, you know, God bless them. They were there working. That's all they knew how to do. They just show up at the session and work, and they don't know from some idiot coming in late to play drums. Where's Hal Blaine? You know, they're probably thinking, what the hell? Anyway, so, but all the rest of the guys were all like normal looking, dressed nice. And, you know, at the session and everything, Mike Dacey was dressed in buckskin, fringe, like long fringe in the buckskin from his arms and his shoulders and everything. It was like this beautiful thing, you know, but it looked like an actor on a set somewhere or something. And I think maybe he had a red bandana or something. It was crazy, but he felt me. He didn't know me, I don't think, but he was making Joe. He was doing a Hal Blaine. He was trying to divert, you know. He was saying stuff that was funny and everything, and then when we started playing, I remember looking at the chart, and I remember thinking, okay, well, this is just, you know, this is nothing. This is a typical drum chart with nothing on it, you know, except the bars and a couple of little figures. And so I thought, okay, I'm good. And so the first rundown felt really good, man. It felt great. You know, it's these cats, you know, when you're doing a record date with those kind of people, they're the best musicians in the world, really, when you think about it. And so you can't go wrong. All you got to do is just try to hang in there and do your best. So I sounded good. Everybody was happy. Jimmy Webb was talking about this and that. We got the take real quick, or several takes, you know, as a commercial. And then Mike Dacey says, he yells out, he says, let's do a version. Oh, no. Jimmy Webb said, we got to do a different kind of little version of the same thing. And so Mike Dacey stood up and said, let's do a 5-4 version. And so I froze. I went, oh, my God. Okay. So, but then I tried to compose myself, and we started and we played it in 5, and it was fantastic because, you know, 5 is very natural in a way. And so you just, you know, everything worked out beautifully. And I remember thinking, and then Dacey gave me the, you know, the okay sign, like, hey, man, that was good at the end of it. And I remember thinking, oh, my God. I just remember thinking, I remember saying, thank you, Lord. Those were the days, by the way, and I don't want to get religious on you guys or political, either one, right? But having said that, those were the days for me when I realized that every time I sat down to play, I would pray before I would play. I did that then, and I do that today.
Great.
And it worked.
Yeah. Well, amen to that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jimmy Webb had the same experience, but the opposite with Hal. Jimmy Webb and I think Don and my dad, they might have been doing a Motown Christmas thing when Jimmy was just starting out. And it was Jimmy's music, whatever it was, and he was the leader. And he walked in, and he was really nervous. And he said at the end, Hal gave him the okay sign. So he said, you're going to do well, kid. He said it changed everything in his life. You know, yeah. That was the beginning of Jimmy.
Well, I'm telling you, man, it's so important. It is so very important to have somebody like that in your life, man. I was so blessed to have a Hal Blaine in my life. My God, you know. And look at that with Tommy. They made history, those guys.
Yeah, I know. Look at
they
that.
They made big time history. They showed everybody how to do it.
Yeah. Hey, Danny.
Would you buy a used car from any of those guys?
No way.
Yeah, they told me the story.
Danny, I know you've told this story 1,000 times, and I asked you to do it once before on my podcast. But there's a great story of the guys doing a film date, or was it at Disneyland or something?
Oh no, it was you talking about the Disney date where they
Disney
were
date. Yeah, and maybe Don was even there too. Maybe Don Randy was there. I don't know, but
I wasn't, but I know the story.
Yeah.
So basically, it was the guys are at this point. You know, that's the difference between record guys. It's always been the case. There's the record guys, then the TV guys, and the film guys. You know, you guys kind of cross over sometimes. And at the time, Don and these guys were the hot record guys, and they get called in to do a rock and roll part in a Disney movie. And
right.
The guy's name was Bob Bruner, I think. Bob Bruner, very straight-laced contractor, conductor. And they send all the string players and all the legit players away for lunch. And they're going to do the rock and roll part of the session. And so, the guy says, okay, we're going to play this really, really slow, guys. And, it, you know, as if these guys had to learn the parts. And they the girl accidentally hits the click track and it's, you know, the regular speed. So it's not half speed or whatever. And it goes boom, 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 boom. And Don, Hal comes in, everything goes, you know, gets all the way across. They nail it, this and that. And that was it. And the guy goes, oh my God. He goes, how did you guys do that? And my father turned and he goes, well, we practice a lot during the day. So
that's great. That's so good.
Constantly busting each other's balls. If you could be the fly in the room and record it, all the busting, that would have been hilarious.
Yeah, yeah. I just love that story, man. It's just like, hey, well, Don Lombardi. I know we had started talking as Jim Keltner arrived about, and you are muted, Don Lombardi, by the way. But I was going to ask you about, just to kind of shift gears for a second, about you made a special Hal Blaine commemorative snare drum at a point.
Yeah, honoring the workshop. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that was one of our commemorative annual snare drums that we did. And Hal came out. We did a nice presentation for him. And I remember after the first time I saw him, we probably all had the stamps all over our walls and all over different places when he would leave.
That is Hal Blaine strikes again. Thank you.
Hal Blaine strikes again.
That was always every place. And I wanted to mention too, because I know, you know, having all the drummers today know where it came from and those guys know where it came from is so important. But he was so well respected, as Jim said, back in the day with his peers. We interviewed Frank DeVito, the late Frank DeVito. We lost another great drummer recently here.
Yeah.
Frank said, you know, in the day, they would, if Hal had a black car, he'd get a black car. If he had a, you know, a certain house, we'd get it. We wanted to be just like him no matter what. So it was, everybody knew back in the day he was doing something that was really special that they were shooting for.
That's right.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. He was. And I, you know, as I think it was Don Randy or maybe it was Jim Keltner that said, I mean, you could, when you got to know him, you could see that he had that quality about him where he would be a leader. He was like a natural born leader where he would just, you know, not in any sort of controlling way either. Right, Don? I mean, he would just be a guy that would just kind of say, let's.
Let's see, am I mute?
No, you were okay. Oh, you're muted now, Don.
We were playing in Las Vegas with the Nancy Sinatra show, and Billy Strange was the conductor. Billy Strange never had that band. That band was Hal Blaine's band, and unfortunately for the rest of the org, Billy would forget the count. He counted off 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. And Hal would put it boom, 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 right where it was supposed to be. But you got to remember, there was a whole orchestra. And if you follow the leader, right or wrong, that's where he counted. Hal Blaine said, no fucking way. He counted off, and Hal Blaine would put it where it's supposed to be. Unfortunately, after some of the shows, I get approached, what's going on? We can never start together. We can never. I said, it's not my job, and I would walk away. That's the way it was. Al knew where we had to go. Yeah. And I what was it? I forget, one time Billy and him got into it, and Al said, be careful, I'll follow you.
Yeah. I remember him somehow. I got to hear him play with H.B. Barnum Band, right?
Yeah.
Did you do that, Don? Were you?
Yes, I did. Many of those. Yeah.
Well, you're probably on that date, but I'll never forget that, man. It was a kind of a, it was a big band, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
At least a big, extra big rhythm section or something. But it was like a Bo Diddley beat but not the New Orleans Bo Diddley. It was some odd kind of thing. It just, to this day, it's one of my favorite kind of things, and occasionally I'll be able to play something similar to it, but otherwise I'll never forget, man, how funky it was, the power.
Yeah. And you know something? And HB loved the way Hal played. He loved the way Earl played. But I think HB preferred Hal on certain things, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
The energy level, perhaps, you know.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, Earl to me was more of a jazz player. I remember being at PCC, Pasadena City College, and an assembly during the afternoon one time. Earl came, he played with, and to this day I cannot remember the girl singer, but she was a kind of a famous jazz girl at the time. Maybe you know.
I don't know who it could be. Anyway,
he was, you know, she was like a real jazz singer. And I don't remember who the bass player was, but it was just a trio backing her. And it was killing. Earl was fantastic. I remember thinking Earl sounded like Shelley.
Yeah, that's interesting.
They had that same kind of feel and sound, same kind of sound. They got the same kind of sound out of the drums. That affected me really big time those days, man. The sound that they got, like the sound of Hal's cymbals and his snare. The drummers in those days did not hit the middle part, the fat part of the stick, in a rim shot. You know, you guys know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they didn't come down like that. You know, that's not the way the backbeat was played in those days. And that's where I come from. And so when I had to start doing that, you know, I did it, and that's the way I play now, unfortunately. But the real way was the way those guys played it, man. If you got a chance to see Hal and Earl play in rhythm sections, playing rock and roll and stuff, pop music, that's the way it should be. I mean, I promised myself that I was not going to try to be. I'm going to try not to be one of these old guys and say, back in the day, it was better, you know. But I'm trying not to say that, really. Although most drummers, and especially drummers, nobody's my age, you know. But drummers, you know, underneath me, like 10, 15 years younger, so they will know what I'm talking about. The best sound from the drums is from using your wrists, you know, and that's the way I came up. I saw Philly Joe Jones play, man. I saw Elvin play, and these were guys that played firm, hard, but beautiful. They played from the wrist. There, I said it. Now I'm an old guy talking about it.
Now, Jim, you're the Jedi Master. You are the Jedi Master of the drums.
Well, I got to say, since we're talking about, about Earl as well, one of the most memorable days of my life was going out to pick up Earl at his house out in on the way to Palm Desert. I remember Hal was living in Palm Desert or in Palm Springs, but the British drummer, Steve White, quite well-known drummer.
Yeah.
Actually,
yeah.
Check out some of his stuff on YouTube. He's a great drummer. He and I, along with Louise, who I know Jim knows, Louise King, and she put a little trip together where Steve and I went out to Earl's. We picked up Earl. Then we traveled to Palm Springs, where we met Hal at his favorite deli, Manhattan in the Desert.
Yeah.
And so to get Earl and Hal together and just sit there and listen to the two of them,
yeah.
You know, it was such an amazing day and so memorable. I know Jim and I had, with Chad, I think one time we had dinner with Earl somewhere as well.
Yeah. But
just Earl is just, you know, I was really kind of friendly with Earl the last 10 years of his life as well. And I just wanted to say, one time I was at Chadney's watching Earl. Remember Jim and Chadney's? Earl would play on Tuesday.
Yeah.
And I actually got to commiserate with Charlie Watts about this, but I'm sitting there at a table watching Earl play. All of a sudden, who walks in? Jim and Charlie Watts together. And then not only did they sit, not that they sat in the looking out, of course, you know, as a drummer, you want to watch from the back, as Jim was saying, or from the side. So the two of them go and sit in a booth, which was because Earl's set up on the floor, right? You know, in the lounge there, right, Jim? So I'm there. I am sitting there. I'm looking at Jim, Charlie Watts, and Earl. And Charlie's, both of them transfixed on Earl from the side. And another one of these very memorable things. I got to share that with Charlie back in 2019. And he's like, oh, you were there. And I was like, yeah, amazing. Anyway, yeah. Since Earl came into the mix a little bit, and both of them were, Hal and Earl were so influential, unbeknownst to me, and probably to Dennis originally. I know Dennis is pretty much a scholar of this stuff, as he was mentioning about Hal's record set I had no idea about. But, you know, the two of them were so influential on me, unbeknownst to me, because really at the time they didn't get the credit, as you guys were saying, as the Wrecking Crew film came out. And, you know, as time goes on and people learn about the roots of rock and roll, really, which is begins with, you know, the Wrecking Crew, along with, you know, especially the 60s roots of the 60s rock and roll. And of course, all the work that Hal did and Don did on Pet Sounds and all these things, so influential on me. So it was great to see a little bits and pieces of that firsthand, seeing Hal play a couple of times at NAMM, seeing Earl play at Chadney's quite a bit. It's just such an education. Just wanted to throw that in there about the two of them.
Yeah.
You know, there was a time where there was so many wonderful drummers, and there was enough work for everybody, including Hal and Earl and Jimmy Gordon and Ed Green. Who am I leaving out? There was a couple more.
Jimmy Keltner.
There was so much going on at that point.
Frank DeVito.
There was enough for everybody, you know.
Yeah.
And they all were terrific drummers.
Yeah. One of the things we haven't talked about is the comedy of Hal Blaine.
Oh.
There was, my God, there was, for those who'd never met Hal Blaine, you could be anywhere and he will find a joke out of nowhere. It was ridiculous. I mean, it could have been a parking meter, and he'll tell a joke about a parking meter.
Yeah.
And it was constant. And
I think he was a frustrated stand-up comedian.
Extremely frustrated.
Yeah.
And there was nothing better. I mean, sometimes he got like, okay, it's like being on the road where you guys deal with it all the time. You hear the same set with the same comedian. So we would hear the same stuff. You know, what's the hardest thing for a studio musician? You know,
So what's the hardest thing for studio musician? What was it?
Finding a parking space.
Oh, fine.
So then there was
who told that story when we were up, as I'd mentioned, Don and I were up in Palm Springs to present posthumously the star, and Danny was there to Hal up in Palm Springs there. Who told the story about the Hal at after the Tammy show? You recall that? You know, the famous Tammy show?
That's where he took the stones back to his house?
Yeah. So the punchline of that story, right, was he had Charlie and a couple others, Rolling Stones. Oh, you want to see my house, Hollywood Hills house or whatever?
Yeah.
And they're pulling up to the driveway, and he presses down on the accelerator, and he's heading right for the garage, like he's going to crash into the garage. But they had never seen, you know, being underprivileged in England in the 60s, never saw an automatic garage door opener. So just about to hit the garage door opener. God, I forget who told that story, but that's like so funny.
I remember that.
Yeah. So
that's far as his sense of humor.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So I just remember the first time being in that deli. And this is where, you know, there's nothing where, I mean, he'd sit there and he'd go like this. He goes, Jesus, this food killed more Jews than Hitler.
Yeah, he is that one guy.
But then this is my favorite though. So Michael Kravitz is Hal has to do is being honored at a Sinatra thing in the desert. He doesn't. This is at the end. He barely remembers that he has to do this thing. I remember Michael making sure that he got ran out, got him a pair of pants because you remember it was always shorts.
Always shorts.
Yeah. So he gets, now the host of this dinner is basically a deli that's hosting this. And of course he starts with that joke. This food killed more people than Hitler. And there's no laugh at this event. It just died. And then it was just, couldn't get him off the stage at that point. It was like dying.
I remember at the 70th at the Baked Potato where Don put me on the spot. I had to go and get up and play Be My Baby in front of Hal, which was an honor, but also pretty scary. But I remember Hal was doing a bit of his stand-up, and it was a particularly nasty night, similar to the rain we've been having now. And I remember Hal got up there and said, "Oh, it's raining buckets out there," and I almost kicked one. Something sad.
He had a line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he probably used all of those jokes all the time, but they're effective.
Hey, I was just going to quickly make a comment just to jump back 1 second to what Jim Keltner was saying about Hal's technique and the backbeat. And I was just going to echo what Jim said, basically, in that he played. I know this because when I worked for Zildjian, we made his drumsticks for him, the Hal Blaine stick. And it was like a 7A, as Jim said, a really small, you know what a 7A is, really thin stick. And Jim, you know, and Jim, I think you play this way, or I've seen you do this, where he played with the butt end for the backbeat. So he was able to get that, you know, enough sort of fat sound out of the butt end of a skinny stick. If he used the regular tip, he might have broken it, but he just had it. He had it so dialed in. I remember him telling me, "Well, you know, I play it this way, so I don't need a big stick." He'd say, "This is all I need.
Did he do that on his left hand
on the snare drum? Yeah.
And always turned around.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. He's always playing with the butt end. I watched him enough times to see that he would play according to the music. You know, you got to let the music tell you what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And would play he'd play the fat backbeat, you know, rim shot.
Yeah.
And then he'd play in the middle of the drum just at the right time. He'd go back and forth, and you know, you can't, if you say this and then you go and try to do it, it's going to be stupid. You can't do that. You know, you have to do it. You have to let the music
instinctively.
Yeah. And he did that so beautifully. I used to just, so for years I played like that. I always used small sticks. I used a stick called a 3D, a Gretsch 3D, with a little round bead, very similar to what Jeff Porcaro started using years later, only it was longer. But the one that, but I always did what Hal did. I always turned it around backwards and played the backbeat like that. But then leaving the traditional grip behind was something that I regretted. I regretted it for a long time, and then I got used to playing match grip. And so that's all I do now is match grip. And I saw Steve Gadd a few weeks ago here in LA playing with his band. And, you know, he's a famous traditional grip guy, right? I mean, he probably played it as pretty as anybody ever. Mm. And and he would switch over to match grip, and he still had the same feel, the same beautiful dexterity and everything. You know, it's kind of an inevitable thing for us to do. You know, you should be able to play both.
Yeah.
Something else interesting about Hal, and you will attest this, every drummer will, he wasn't afraid to try new stuff. I remember when the Syndrums came out. You remember the electronic? Yeah. Hal was the first one to have that. He had the Rototoms. He was the first one to have those.
Yeah.
And, you know, introducing it and being like the leader he was, you know, and everybody followed along to see, wow, this is the latest thing Hal Blaine is doing. And he did that over and over again, his approach to stuff. But the thing that Clem was saying about having the play Be My Baby, that dotted quarter, eighth note and quarter note has been copied in 10 million records forever. And that was the line he made up. You know, nothing was written like that. He decided that's the way that's going to be. And that's been over and over. That one lick has been in God knows how many songs.
That's right. And the floor toms.
Here's those rototoms.
Yeah.
But but he did that beat, Don, before he got those drums, right?
Oh, that's right. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, he did that, the beat you're talking about, he did that in those Ludwig blues.
Yes.
That were just, and I don't ever remember him having two toms up on the bass drum. It was always a classic four-piece. But that floor tom sound that he got was the key to that beat.
Right, sure. The snare and the floor tom simultaneously.
Simultaneously. Yeah. Snare and floor.
But his,
you
his
got it, Clint.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to show just one more quick photo. This is a photo Denny sent me, the seven records of the year photo, which is just talking about Hal's incredible. I mean, God, I mean, it's just when you read the book and you realize his legacy, his how prolific his recording career was. It's just.
Someone was in Papa's stuff on there, I guess, with Adler there, right? Mamas and Papas probably on there.
Yeah, well, I think the records that started, I think, in 65 with Taste of Honey. And I think 66, maybe Strangers in the Night, maybe. 67, Up, Up and Away. 68, maybe Mrs. Robinson.
Yeah, I can read Herb Albert, Tijuana Brass, 66. Strangers in the Night, 67. Fifth Dimension, 68.
Oh, okay. Up and Away, was it?
Yeah, and then Simon and Garfunkel, 69. Unless I'm getting the years wrong, I'm just trying to read this thing. I see another Simon and Garfunkel, maybe in 71. 70 is, I can't read it, sorry.
Probably Bridge Over Troubled Water.
Yeah, that's probably, yeah, 71 maybe, yeah. Yeah, it was, I can see that, yep. Love Will Keep Us Together, I think, was the year after that, Captain and Tennille. Right. They're all in the book. Yeah, they're all in the book. It's
but you know what's more remarkable than anything is that the first six of them are consecutive. You know, they're starting in the first, you know, the year after year after year, he had the top record. It's not like he skipped a year.
You know what's also interesting about that is that it could have been any one of those records because he played on so many of them. If it wasn't that record, it would have been another record he played on. Mm. That would have been record of the year because that's how many gigs we were doing one after another. I remember one week he had three sets of drums. I forget the name of the guy that did his valet for him. He had that guy
Rick Fauchet.
Yep. He'd have one set in one studio, another set ready. And so that he could leave one date and get to the next date and the drums would be set up and then leave that date and then go to another date and the drums would be set up there. Right. I think he had three sets of drums for quite a long time just to be able to make all those dates. And it's a time that I wish everybody could have that we had from 1962, I'd say to 1972. There was so much recording going on in Los Angeles in that period of time, but at the same instance, those guys were making hit records. So if you were a producer that worked for Capitol or Warner Brothers, we better get those guys, you know, because we became those bunch of guys that could come up with hit records, and it happened over and over. And I remember Joe Porcaro. When he first came out from Buffalo, from back east, I think it was Buffalo.
Hartford, actually, yeah.
And he brought Jeffy into a date to watch Hal Blaine.
Right.
And Jeffy's sitting there watching Hal Blaine play drums. And I'm just looking over there. And I said, this is the picture we need. That picture of Joe Picaro, Jeff, and Hal Blaine together. It was absolutely, wow. And Jeff's eyes were just wide open, catching every little thing he did. It was amazing. And it was at Gold Star. That was where we were doing those things. Pretty amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. I have a question for Don, if I may, and and for Denny. Maybe he heard his father speak about this, and to Jim, too. When you guys were making all these records back in the day, did you have a sense that there would be such lasting power to the music, or did you think it was just a fad, some of the rock and roll things that were going on at the time?
Well, I never would have thought it would have been going on this long, that's for sure. But we didn't really know we were making hit records. We were supporting our families. You know, we were this is how we lived. That was our lives. We were in day and night, and I had to play live. Even though I were doing all that recording, I still had to play live in a nightclub. I just had to do that to let it out, you know, because it is a little bit confining when you have to stick to the one thing you're doing. But for that whole time, it was an amazing time. I don't think it will ever be repeated, mainly because of the way everything is recorded. To have a three sets of drums and three different studios and all being active in one day, you know, that's pretty damn amazing.
That's incredible. Yeah.
The other thing with those guys, and there's a big difference, and it's funny because the immediate family, the other film I just did, and Jim could attest to this, when the changeover from, it's a three-hour session, they're bouncing around, and they don't even remember what they did.
Right.
You know, so they give that piece of music. I remember for my father, when Jimmy Webb gave him a charm as a gift for winning Up, Up, and Away Grammy, gave him a little Grammy charm. He goes, what's this for? He goes, it's for when we did the Fifth Dimension Up, Up, and Away last year. He didn't even know he was on it. And that's because they didn't spend enough time in the studio they weren't always, the singers weren't always there.
Right.
So they don't remember the music they were playing, I think, for my father. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of stuff that's lost in that era. Whereas the 70s, you guys, all of you, started working longer and spent time on those songs with the artist, or if you were the artist. You know, I think there was a different mentality of making music because it just changed. Technology changed. Right. So I think for my father, a lot of it was, don't forget, he's coming out of World War II as a kid. And that's only, he's lucky to play guitar and get paid. He didn't expect to be he wasn't meant to be a guitar player. That wasn't a profession that he thought he could even have. So I think he didn't care what he played, as dumb or stupid or amazing as it was. He didn't care. He was just happy to make a living at something he loved doing.
Yeah.
So it wasn't something he strived for until much later.
Yeah.
Well, there was that anonymity amongst the session musicians. Like I was saying, as a kid, we really didn't know who was playing on those records. We just knew they were great, you know, and influencing us. But the name check was not there. You know, is that there's anonymity they had at the time, I suppose.
What was the Charlie quote? When I came to the U.S. for the first time, I wanted to meet my five favorite drummers and my five favorite bands. I found out they were all Hal Blaine.
And to Denny, I mean, would you say that the fact what Clem just said about the fact that they were anonymous, you know, they and you know guys like Hal and your dad and Don didn't get credited. Did that even bother them, or were they just so busy? Yeah, right. They just probably just
because I think it was part of the gig. Don could answer for himself, but
sure,
for my father, I think it was just part of the, again, it wasn't like, oh my God, they're famous. Now they aren't given any credit. Do you know what I mean? The first, don't forget, they're coming out of singles. They're all doing singles in the 60s.
Yeah.
You know, the single single, and then it becomes an album. Now the albums come out, they're still not putting the names on. Maybe Lou Adler did with Jan and Dean, and he did it with the Mamas and Papas. But it didn't bother them that much, I think, until later when they realized having an album credit could mean a difference. Mm-hmm. And seeing that with these guys in the 70s, it made a big difference for their careers. Not that the guys in the Wrecking Crew needed a jump in their careers, but I think it was later that they would have appreciated it more. Don't you think, Don?
I the first ones that started doing it was Phil Spector and Brian Wilson. They forced the majors.
No. I disagree. Brian Wilson did not.
No, Phil didn't.
That sounds didn't have any credit to you guys. That was the whole point. The Beach Boys deprecated you.
That happened later on. But Phil's had our names on those albums. He was the first one. I remember way back when. And it took Brian a long time, it's like in the Wrecking Crew film itself. When you see that one section, you realize that most of those bands couldn't play. I mean, when we went in with Dino, Desi, and Billy, they got three major hits, and it was Hal Blaine and a bunch of the Wrecking Crew guys, including myself. Those kids were tiny. They were 8 years old. They were 5 years old.
they weren't that young.
But it was Hal Blaine that played the drums on it.
Well, it's like, obviously, like Jim was saying, the difference between making a record and just going in doing a show, it's a vast difference, especially back then, So, I mean, that's why even Ringo, right, when they did Love Me Do, similar to what Jim was saying, I was in the background in case the drummer, in that case, Jim, couldn't cut it. It's a similar scenario with Ringo, I believe, and back in the early days with George Martin as well, with trying to remember the other drummer that played.
Andy White.
Who's the drummer that played? Andy White, right, that played on the original Love Me Do and all. Yeah.
Yeah. You guys think part of the magic in those days, too, that we talk about, Hal, was that everybody was in the same room at the same time.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Feeding off one another. Right. Making it.
Yeah. Whole different situation. Yeah. Whole band, orchestra. Yeah.
That's very important because it's something that kind of went by the wayside for quite a time. And now I think it's coming back where people are going back.
Well, now it's all different ways to do it now. Right? So many different ways.
I was at Berklee School of Music about 2 months ago in Boston.
Right.
And they asked me to do a Phil Spector date. And they set the drums up. And unfortunately, we did it. And it was absolutely incredible. They had four girl singers from the school, the drummer. And then I said, I put up one finger. And they said, what is that? I said, it's called mono. and they all looked at me. I said, the same thing in this one room was recorded on one piece of tape. And how did they get Hal's drums on it? They got Hal's drums. How did they get the? It was all done in mono. And that's the way it was. And here they are with Pro Tools. It doesn't matter. It's infinity.
Yeah.
Yeah. 48 tracks. Yeah.
The digital world. Right. It's good to go in and record live as well.
It is live.
Yeah.
I
know I've kept you guys on a long time and I so appreciate this. I did want to mention to Jim Keltner because you weren't here when I said it, but Max Weinberg would have been here today. I spoke with Max over the weekend. Today is Bruce Springsteen's mom's funeral. So Max sends his regards to everybody and his regrets that he couldn't be here today. But and Danny Serafin was going to join us, but had a realized he had another appointment. So, but I thought maybe you guys might appreciate if we close it off today with a little number.
Who's on the castanets there?
Just wait and
Those fills at the end where Hal goes for it, man. I always love that part of that song where he's just, I'm picturing Phil Spector, like, you know, conducting and telling Hal, go for it, you know.
And that was another signature thing, the three against the four that, you know, was kind of classic. Yeah.
Also, Phil wouldn't let Hal play Phil's till he was getting ready to make the final takes.
Yeah.
He did spare him that. And then, then when you knew Hal was starting to get crazy, we were getting close to the end.
Wow.
Because we were there, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours sometimes. And we were waiting for, okay, when is Hal going to start playing Phil's?
That's, you know, I remember reading in Hal's book, Jim, you wrote the foreword to Hal's book. And I could quote this from that, where you said he played with such confidence. And in that song, to me, that's a great example of just his playing sounds so confident. It's so, the beat is so definite. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, he's just, the beat is so right there. It's, there's no ambiguity over where the beat's going to be. It's just like,
he played like that naturally. That was some natural thing from him. He didn't come from any kind of rock and roll world, or he came from kind of not jazz, but kind of who would he play? He played with some singers.
he played with a lot of pop singers, I'll tell you what, I think it was just natural for him,
right?
And he just knew how to come up with it. You know, it was just there.
Yeah, so the thing is that we've always read that, you know, people, musicians play who they are. The guitar player, piano, drums, who you are. And the whole thing of all the experience that you've amassed, that's what you play. And with Hal, that's obviously what we're hearing. And when I hear Hal playing like that, it reminds me of Jimmy Gordon, because Jimmy picked that up.
He did.
And went his whole career with that. He knew Hal before, you know, when he was still a teenager, I think it was when Jimmy met Hal. And then ended up playing, like, with the Wrecking Crew, you know, percussion and things like that. So he had Hal Blaine all in his DNA.
Yeah.
And that was the other reason why when I met Jim Gordon, I became like a disciple of his, because he was another version of Hal Blaine, with that same confidence, that same wonderful kind of thing that I always wanted and never, I knew instinctively that I would never have that somehow, because I didn't lean toward it. I didn't, you know, I still was with Elvin and those guys, you know, and yeah, yet
you found it, but good, believe yeah. me.
Well, I never got that feeling, that confident thing that those guys had. Jimmy and Hal personified that. If you listen to all that, that's what I used to tell Jeff Porcaro, man. Jeff used to try to be silly and play crazy stuff, and he loved when I would play something stupid and he would try to copy it. And I told him over and over, listen to Jimmy Gordon. You already got Hal in there. Listen to Jimmy now, and you're going to have an incredible recording career. I had to tell him that. Mm. And fortunately, he listened.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Well, that, yeah, man. We could play.
And one more thing. Let me just say one more thing.
Absolutely.
And Don will, I'll say this because Don is on this thing. Spector, you know, ended badly, right? His whole life ended so badly. But he was fucking amazing. I loved playing with Phil Spector. Everything I ever did that had Phil Spector as the producer was, for me, it was amazing. I mean, wouldn't you say that Spector was...
We did 21 million selling records in a row at one point. I mean, that's why we got hired. You know,
that speaks for itself.
Who are you
going to
hire? You know,
right.
He had a knack. Also, let's not forget Jack Nitzsche as an arranger.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. As an arranger.
And most arrangers would rely on Hal, so they didn't have to write out a drum part. They didn't know how to write a drum part, most of the guys. They would leave the bar lines and rely on Hal's ability to come up with it, you know, or Jimmy Gordon, for yourself. I've watched Clem come up with stuff. You know, you come up with stuff because the arranger gives you the space to do that, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
It was an important part of that. And especially when you're coming up with it over and over again as a necessity, it's important. It's so important.
Right. Exactly. Well,
thank you guys.
Good to see you guys. My goodness.
Yeah, it's good to see everyone. Yes. Nice t-shirt, John. Nice t-shirt.
Yeah, absolutely. I've heard
of that place, the Baked Potatoes. Yeah. I've been there a couple of times. Yeah.
Yes, we all have. We have to pay homage to the men. Yes, Dennis.
Hey, John, before we close, does anybody remember Hal's other life as an inventor?
Yes.
Yeah, and I have right here a thing he gave me in 1988. It's called the Hal Blaine Easy. And it was his bid for people who fly or dive. You breathe. Did you have this, Don?
I have it.
What is it for?
It's supposed to be when you're flying and you're descending and to keep your ears from blocking up.
You breathe into
this thing through your nostril. And inflate this balloon.
Does it work?
It's a balloon.
Oh, I never tried it.
You know what it is? There's a balloon. There's a balloon attached to that. And when you put it in your nose, it blows the balloon and it takes the pressure off your ears.
Yeah,
but it never went. You never
produced with it. He appeared on a TV show called "Why Didn't I Think of That?" about inventors. I remember seeing him trying to promote this.
Wow. See, Dennis, you're a man of just all that trivia knowledge. It's
he's
awesome.
He's a scholar. He's a scholar.
He is. Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you all so much for being here. Once again, Denny Tedesco, the man behind the Wrecking Crew and the immediate family. Clem Burke.
Great film.
Drummer extraordinaire with so many bands. Don Lombardi, my dear friend and former boss. Don Randy. Dennis Dykin.
Thank you.
The Jedi Master himself, Jim Keltner. Jim, I said this before you got here today. I always have more spring in my step when I know I'm going to see you. So,
that's lovely.
Bless your heart, man.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here. Thank you, guys. Guys, hang tight for a second. I'll end the stream and we'll say goodbye. But thanks for being here, all you guys. I love you all. Thanks for watching, everybody. And God bless Hal Blaine.
Hal Blaine strikes again.
Absolutely. There you go. Strikes again.
See you guys.
All right. Well, that's my show. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, give it a like, leave me a comment. Don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel if you haven't done that already. And the podcast is available on all the podcast platforms. So download it And remember, no drummers are ever harmed on Live From My Drum Room or Track Talk. And drummers, when in doubt, leave it out. All right. Again, thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. And I'll see you again real soon. See ya.